Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Tonight on Standing Room Only, food and memory stories. Tonight on Standing Room Only, we will feature a variety of stories about food and memory from Rachel Barr's classroom at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. These students wrote a short story about a recipe that is important to themselves or to their culture and recorded the anecdote for the show. The format of this program will be a little different. Students will be introduced one by one with their anecdote to follow. Recipes and photographs will be posted on the website after the show. We begin now with Esperanza Rodriguez reading an introduction and Alicia Wells reading her piece entitled A Drink in Hillbilly Roots.
Inspired by the New York Times food issue dedicated to the celebration of lost foods, WFHB asked students in Ms. Barr's John Olet class of the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship to individually explore an unforgettable meal they vividly remember sharing with their family, friends, and strangers, or to talk about a foreign culture reflecting on the food, people, and setting in order to effectively illustrate the culture, environment, and traditions. They were asked to answer the question, how can culinary traditions connect a region or person to their cultural history? It should be noted that each story told is linked to a recipe and related picture on the WFHB website, as well as additional annotations to explore. Thank you and let us eat. Pun intended.
Hi, my name is Alicia Wells, and I will be reading A Drink in Hillbilly Roots. My family, we are blacksmiths, so naturally we go to a lot of festivals and perform or sell our products. One festival I remember going to every year was a festival held up in Elnora, Indiana. This festival is less of a festival and more of a big flea market that shows the old tradition from the pioneer days. My family and I always hung around the other blacksmiths and locomotive people, and when we would get time, we would walk around and look at the farm animals, attend the tractor show, and look at all the other equipment. Looking back now, it all seems a little country. Well, when my dad wasn't at the forge, we were out and about. When we started walking around, we would go to this one booth that sold the best drink in Elnora, this drink being homemade root beer. This liquid gold sold in a bright blue flip-top bottle was the thing that made me look forward to Elnora every year. It was sweet, refreshingly cold, served it from a barrel in the midst of all the other vendors. Everywhere you looked, everybody had a jug of it. The particular thing about this soda was it was sold flat. I once asked my dad why the soda was sold flat. I mean, soda has to fizz in order to be soda, right? Not that it really mattered. By the time you took your first few drinks, you forgot it wasn't even there. Well, he explained to me that in the old ways of carbonating a drink, it had included fermenting it, giving it a low alcohol content. So by not fermenting it, all the little kids and the rest of the family could enjoy the drink. Still, to this day, my dad and I get root beer together every time we go. We always look forward to it, and sometimes we refill our bottles 5 times per visit. We still love to walk around and laugh with our friends, and we still love that flat soda. It brings back happy memories and creates many more. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Jada Pete read her piece entitled, I Do Anything for Meatloaf.
My story is entitled, I Do Anything for Meatloaf. I'm Jada Pete. Since I was a little girl to today, I remember seeing my mom in the kitchen making her famous meatloaf. When I was younger, I never understood why my mom would put so many weird things into this dish or why this meal was so popular in our family. I was always looking over her shoulder, giving her my unwanted opinions like, ew, what is that? Or, who puts uncooked oatmeal oats and saltine crackers into their meatloaf? I gave so many unwanted opinions that I was eventually asked to leave the kitchen since I was judging everything instead of helping out. To this day, when I ask my mom how this meal came about, she still tells me, I don't really know. I watched my mom make it as a child, so I did the same but with my own spin. Now that I've grown older, I realize that the nasty ingredients that my mom was adding into her meatloaf is what made it taste so good and gave it its signature flavor. The things that my mom adds into her meatloaf is what makes it so different and unique from the others. My mom's meatloaf is an easy meal to cook, so it often doesn't take her long to make it. But when she does finally decide to make it, it isn't for a holiday or anything. It's just a meal that we have on a night that we're ready to have a quick dinner. I remember one evening when she didn't really feel like making a big dinner and everyone was in agreement for us to have meatloaf. It started off as my mom making dinner for four, which then turned into seven. My other family members decided to visit that night, and the night my mom was making her famous meal. This was a lucky night for all of us, I guess. What started out as a small dinner turned into a big family dinner, with all of us connecting with family members that can be too busy to stop by sometimes. To me, this night felt like a special holiday that no one even knew about. Reflecting back to when I was little, not understanding why these kinds of ingredients were added into my mom's famous dish, I now understand how significant it is. Her meatloaf not only had different ingredients, but this was the main reason why it was so different. Other meatloafs that I've tried could never compare to my mother's. Sometimes I still don't understand how she can add all of these weird things and not have certain measurements on how much to add and still make it taste so delicious and be one of my favorite meals that she makes. She's passed down her recipe to all of my older sisters and now they make it for their families. I can't wait for the day that the recipe is taught to me so I can make it for my own family one day and explain to my kids that what I'm adding into the meatloaf may look different, but it's what makes this meal so special. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Vivian Thomas read her piece entitled Zucchini Linguine Three Times Fast.
Hi, I'm Vivian, and I'll be reading Zucchini Linguine Three Times Fast. Zucchini Linguine, Zucchini Linguine, Zucchini Linguine. My many siblings and I would repeat to see who could say it the fastest without fumbling over the tongue twister. Not only was it fun to say, it was delicious. All eight children approved. We have a rather large family, so preparing a meal all of us will eat or enjoy is quite challenging. The ingredients to this dish are simple. Linguine noodles, olive oil, and zucchini. But simple can be very good when combined with just the right ingredients, even if only three. Any extra ingredients would make it weird. Our family was taught to eat our greens from a very early age. We kept a garden full of tasty vegetables. The whole family was required to pitch in when gardening. I remember specifically having to pull more weeds than the great number of zucchini that grew. Summers were the best. Because the zucchini was at an abundance, my mom would cook it up with some noodles and olive oil. We would gather in our backyard to devour the exquisite meal. I suppose we enjoyed the meal so much it became our traditional summer cuisine. Our already large family has grown to about 13 people, calling for even more zucchini linguine. We don't eat it as much as we used to, but the memory of the many meals filled with veggies and noodles we once had still linger in our memories. To this day, we chant Zucchini Linguine Three Times Fast.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear a story by Thomas Anders entitled Nana's Three-Day Rule.
I'm Thomas Anders, and this is Nana's Three-Day Rule. I remember one of my favorite parts of the Thanksgiving holiday season was going to my mamaw's house. I loved seeing all the family and spending time with them. But to me, that wasn't really that important. The food is what I really wanted. I can remember food was always a big thing in our family. It was the tradition. At every Thanksgiving, we had to have turkey, stuffing, mashed potatoes, green beans, corn, sweet potatoes, apple pie, pumpkin pie, and my favorite, banana pudding. And of course, cherry pie. But like I said, banana pudding and cherry pie were always my favorite. So let's just skip over all the other things and get right to the good stuff like I always wish we could. My mamaw always used to tell me the older the banana pudding was, the better it tasted. So she would always make it 3 to 4 days in advance. This made it so all the flavors could combine and it would get mushy and delicious. The best part was always when you got a spoonful of vanilla wafer in the banana. The thought of it sends me back to when I can almost taste it, how delicious it was. I really think that the three-day rule was just something my mamaw made up, but it was how she did things, and how she still does things. It's a family tradition, and that's how we make it. It's how I connect with my papaw because it was always his favorite food, and when we make it the way he liked it, it makes me think of him. It makes me remember the good times from my childhood. Now, cherry pie was different than the banana pudding. My Aunt Tammy always used to bring the cherry pie because my uncle didn't like apple or pumpkin. That's how I got introduced to it. The thing was, it always was just a cherry pie from Kroger's. She didn't make it, and I don't think she made it a tradition on purpose. But even when she didn't come to Thanksgiving, I always made sure someone brought a cherry pie, because that was my favorite, and now I can't think of a Thanksgiving or really any other special event without it. The thing is the food itself isn't that important. It's just food, but it's the memories that really matter. It's memories that allow us to connect with other people and relate with them, and remember the good times. I think that's why we carry on the traditions that we do now in our family. Like the 3-day rule. Who knows if it was really improves the taste of the food, but it's how we always have done it, and how we always will do it, because that's what allows us to connect with everyone in the family, and remember the good times.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. You've been listening to Food and Memory Stories on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to stories from students in Rachel Barr's classroom at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. These students were assigned to write and record either a story about their favorite memory of a food or a story about a food that revolves around a culture. We now return to hear a story by Tasha Shaw entitled The Roots of the Caco Bean.
Hi guys, my name is Tasha, and today I'm going to be reading to you The Roots of the Caco Bean. 5,000 years ago, people roamed the Americas in tribes and civilizations such as the Mayans and the Yucatans, as well as the ancient people of Olmec. These people had many different cultures and traditions, varying from their festivities to their food. But there is one food they always had in common, and most of us eat it today. This food is the caco bean, or in English terms, the cocoa bean. The caco bean could be considered one of the healthiest superfoods in the world because of its nutrient-packed origins. Let's take a look at the history of the bean for a minute to see what makes it so special. You see, humans didn't discover the caco bean. It was actually monkeys. The caco pod doesn't only consist of the beans, though. Inside is a tangy fruit that is said to be a lot like a grapefruit that holds them. So, when the monkeys opened the pod and ate the fruit, they found the bean in their food and they would spit it out. It was the saliva that would sweeten the bean while it sat in the sun until the tribes found it and began using the bean to put into foods. Without the bean going through the sitting process, it was described to have the flavor of a potato and had a very chewy texture. Now, chocolate goes through a different process, so you don't have to worry about your chocolate being covered in monkey spit anymore. For centuries, people would use this bean in different drinks and foods such as chicken mole, a Mexican dish, and desserts such as brownies, cakes, and chocolate drinks. One of my favorite foods, in fact, is made with this bean, and many of you probably love it as much as I do. This food is chocolate. The making of this dish is fun, but it can be a bit challenging. It consists of caco bean nibs, ground sugar crystals, a singular vanilla bean, caco butter, and almonds. The caco bean is delicious, but don't eat it raw. It's not as tasty as the food it's contained in. I should know from experience. I tried it before I came up here. But let's move on from the flavor and the origins to the region it grows in. Today, the caco bean is known to grow near the equator in warm temperatures in Mexico and northern South America. The tree that grows these pods that the beans are contained in is the Thebroma caco species. It's compared to a lemon tree in appearance, except it has a smaller amount of leaves and it's a bit bigger in size. The pods themselves that grow, they're like footballs and they're half a foot long with bright orange color and smooth as well as bumpy ridges. Through the centuries in ancient cultures, caco was harvested from these trees and was not only a main ingredient in Aztecan food, but also played a part in their tradition and art.
In fact, the Olmec's pottery is known to have included the bean in their clay concoctions and paint bases. They also used it in ceremonies as a way to thank the god Quetzalcoatl, the god of wisdom, due to the belief that the bean was a gift from him and to his people. Years later, the Mayans used the bean in its chocolates as a way to seal marriage of the Mixtec ruler Eight Deer of Monte Albán, a sacred site in the valley of Oaxaca. Some research shows that in some places, a woman had to be able to make cacao to show that she could make it with the proper froth. Most of the time, cacao alcohol was drank by the rich and high-status people, just like rich people today would drink expensive wine and liquors. Many of the paintings painted by the Aztecs depict cacao as being a godly item and highly important in the Aztec cultures. And based on the love for our Hershey bars and Nesquik milk, we obviously worship it in our own way as well. This rich spice and ingredient has played up its part in history and has survived to live in our present as well. So I think before we take a bite of our Lindor truffle, we should take a moment to remember the roots of the cacao bean and the way it has affected societies and culinary experiences today.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Reagan White recite The Calories Don't Count on Christmas.
I'm Reagan White, and I'm going to be reading Calories Don't Count on Christmas. In the third grade, I was one of those obnoxious kids who took everything way too literally. It was Christmas Eve, and I couldn't have been more excited, or subsequently, more obnoxious. My grandparents came over to celebrate with us, and we decided to have pizza delivered for dinner, but my mom and granny disagreed on how much to get. In an attempt to persuade my granny to buy more pizza, my mom uttered a phrase that would ultimately destine me to 24 hours of pure misery. "Come on, the calories don't count on Christmas!" The gears in my third grade all-too-literal head began turning. The calories don't count on Christmas? I'd have to put this to the test. At that moment, I had pledged to myself that I would eat as much pizza as was humanly possible that night. About an hour later, we sat down to three large pizzas, two orders of breadsticks, three cups of nacho cheese, and Diet Cokes for everyone. As everyone else talked about family and holidays and the latest gossip about who was getting divorced from who, I was busy inhaling slice after slice of that fluffy crust, sweet marinara sauce, and gooey cheese all topped with perfectly seasoned meatballs. I was in heaven. After about seven slices, dinner was over, and everyone went to the living room to watch some traditional Christmas movie together. I, however, still wasn't satisfied and felt that I needed even more food to truly test my theory. I grabbed four Christmas cookies made from store-bought dough and sloppily iced the day before and ran into the living room before my family could get suspicious. As I finally swallowed the last bite of that sweet yet salty crumbling goodness, I was finally content. As I went to bed that night, my stomach was aflutter with butterflies in anticipation of the next day, which was Christmas. It was only then that I had realized that perhaps eating all of that food wasn't the best idea. I grew queasier and queasier until, at about 1 a.m, all hell broke loose. I couldn't have been more wrong. The calories most certainly did count on Christmas. They counted very much, and they counted against me. I spent the rest of the day sick, and now I can't even think of that pizza, much less taste it, without being sent back to that horrible experience. It was the worst Christmas of my life, all because I could never let a figure of speech be a figure of speech. As a word of advice to everyone, calories do in fact count on Christmas. Don't make the same mistake I did. Eat food responsibly, no matter what day it is. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Esperanza Rodriguez read Nothing Fits My Cheeseburger.
I'm Esperanza, and I'm going to be reading Nothing Fits My Cheeseburger. This recipe for my family's cheeseburgers became a tradition when my great-grandma taught my grandma how to make them. My great-grandma loves to cook, and she always swore that before she died, she would teach each of her kids how to cook multiple different creations of her own. Still alive, 87 years old, and still swings her cane like she's playing baseball, she refuses to teach anyone other than her kids the traditional recipe. This recipe has been a tradition for nearly six decades. This all started when my great-grandmother began to have this weird obsession with bacon bits and jalapenos. She would eat those two things with anything and everything, but when she tried them with any ordinary cheeseburger, I guess her brain just exploded with a great idea. It started as a habit, just a regular routine of her just doing it. Then her siblings, husband, kids, and parents caught on to it. Months and years later, it got so popular throughout the family, it just became a tradition over the years, especially during the summer when it was the perfect temperature and time for cookouts or family gatherings. When my grandmother got older and had some children of her own, she decided that she would pass down some recipes of her own, including this one. Now that my mom has grown up and put some big girl panties on, she has now taught me. As she was teaching me, she would say, "One thing you have to make sure not to do is squish the cheeseburger." And I would ask why. She would say, "Well, you're going to squish it, and it's not going to be as tasteful. Cheeseburgers are supposed to be big, greasy, and juicy." Well, I didn't think that was true, and I did. And she caught me. She slapped me. She told me that's not how to cook a cheeseburger. I would say she taught all her kids, but the only one that loves cooking out of all five of us is me. As you can tell, this all started off with a once young but now old lady having a strange obsession with two little foods, and soon turned into a habit. From this habit affecting her and her family, it turned into a tradition. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. You've been listening to Food and Memory Stories on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to stories from students in Rachel Barr's classroom at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. These students were assigned to write and record stories about either their favorite memories surrounding food or a prominent food in a culture that is important to them. You can find all recipes online at wfhb.org. We now return to the show with Randy Vaughn, Hank York, and Tucker Todd reading their piece entitled "There's No Way I Eat That."
"There's No Way I'd Eat That" by Hank York, Tucker Todd, and Randy Vaughn.
A Nordic country with deep roots in ancient Viking culture and food, Norway is home to a wide variety of foods that mostly stem from the country's history of distinct seafaring lifestyles, all of which dictated the foods they now eat. One example of this aquacultural eating is fiskesuppe, or fish soup, a combination of food and various vegetables such as turnips. While it can be made with any fish, some favorites of the Norwegian natives are flounder, cod, and sea trout. Sounds like making fiskesuppe is some fisky business. This fisky fish is still popular in Norway today, thanks to the Nordic heritage found in the area. Even as far back as the Vikings, the Norwegians have been known for taking advantage of the nearby Atlantic Ocean and its wildlife, giving them a sustainable source of food in the form of indigenous fish. They used this food on their long voyages and turned it into dishes such as fiskesuppe to sustain their endeavors.
After the age of the Vikings passed, however, the descendants of the original Vikings adopted these recipes and made them their own, incorporating these dishes into their national identity. This process of enveloping cultural flavors into their national identity resulted in these recipes showing up in the homes of many Norwegian today. In summation, Norway's cultural food stems back to the Vikings. Common dishes, such as fiskesuppe, were found in abundance due to the prevalence of fish in the region, which allowed the Norwegians to rely heavily upon their own natural resources to fuel their voyages. After the age of the Vikings passed, these dishes survived on and made their way into the cultural identity of Norway. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Lynn Martin read "Alaska About That Dish."
"I'll Ask You About That Dish" by Lynn Martin. In the Pacific Northwest, consisting of Oregon, Washington, and Alaska, seafood and game meat are the staple cuisine of the region. There is generally an emphasis on fresh ingredients, simply prepared, but unlike other cuisine styles, there are various recipes for each dish, which none of them considered more or less right than the others. This has led some food critics to doubt whether it is a cuisine in the traditional sense of the word. Salmon is a staple of the native Alaskan diet, most specifically the Yupik tribe, and natives have traditionally used all parts of the fish. One of the traditional delicacies is fermented salmon heads. The dish has earned the name stink heads. Essentially, the heads of king salmon are buried in the ground in formation pits, put into plastic or wooden barrels, even plastic food storage bags, and left to let nature do its thing for a few weeks or more. The heads are then harvested and consumed as a spongy mash. Stink heads, as a distinct ethnic cuisine, have been discovered in various mainstream media, the latest of which is the Food Network's Bizarre Food Show. In and of themselves, salmon heads are not repulsive. Whole fish dishes are a legitimate part of rustic and haunt cuisine everywhere, and king salmon is a real-world delicacy. What has struck the gross-out nerve is the overriding fact that much of the stink head prep process is less about fermentation and more about rotten decomposition. The dish, by modern culinary standards, is nothing but rotten salmon heads, a bit treasured tribal fart. Imagine a bucket load of large king salmon heads left outside during the warm summer months for a few weeks. Outside the Alaskan culture, the stink head topic is nothing but a novelty. But health-wise, the tradition of stink head consumption poses a real and continued problem to original Alaskan healthcare professionals, faced with frequent and sometimes serious, totally avoidable botulism cases. To conclude, what can be said of strange in one culture's perspective would not be strange in that culture's perspective. A culture's own cuisine could be considered bizarre and possibly repulsive by some outsiders. But the names themselves, their own food is normal and enjoyable in their eyes and mouths. Basically, food can be considered unusual or ordinary depending on the perspective of the foreigners or the locals.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Alex Gilbert and Wendy Wenderoth read Taste the Burn.
This is Alex Gilbert and Whitney Wenderoth with Taste the Burn. Potstickers are fried dumplings that are slightly burnt and crispy on the bottom. Authentic potstickers are made with pork, although some are made with chicken. Either way, potstickers are said to be very delicious. They originated in China, however their exact origin is unknown. Storytelling is very popular in Chinese culture, which has led to a few different stories being told to try to explain the origin of potstickers. A more famous story talks about an old chef who cooked for the royal family. He was cooking a pot of dumplings and had left them cooking for far too long. This caused the bottoms of the dumplings to burn. Afraid of being punished by the emperor, the chef decided to ask his young, bright son what to do with the burnt dumplings. The chef's son requested to present the dumplings to the emperor himself. As he presented them to the emperor questioned him about the burns, to which the son replied, "This is a new recipe called potstickers." The emperor then ate the potstickers and loved them.
Hi. Okay, there's also a lesser known story that talks about an emperor during the Ming Dynasty. One day the emperor went outside in a disguise to a local market to get some food and water. A famous shop that served dumplings heard of the emperor's presence and thought that the emperor might come to their shop. So the chef of the restaurant decided to prepare the dumplings in advance for whenever the emperor came. To his horror, he prepared the dumplings far too early, and by the time the emperor got there, they were completely cold. The chef thought of a brilliant idea and decided to fry the dumplings in a pan while slightly burning the bottom to make them extra crispy. When the emperor tasted the fried dumplings, he was amazed at how delicious they were. The emperor absolutely loved the bursts of flavor and the crispiness on the bottom and the softness on the top. When the emperor asked the chef what he called his dish, the chef wasn't sure what to say. So the emperor suggested potstickers, and that's where they got their name.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Madeline Hodges read One World, One Curry.
One World, One Curry by Madeline Hodges. In 2008, Disney premiered the feature film The Cheetah Girls, One World. This brightly colored and Bengal-laden Bollywood-esque musical film was my first exposure to life outside of Western culture. At 8 years old, my love for Bollywood began. I was drawn to the fashion and general aesthetics of the nation, but most of all, I was fascinated by the weddings. The ending scene of the aforementioned movie shows a lively wedding reception. The formalities of the wedding were beautiful, and so was the cuisine. Then, at 12 years old, I ate Indian food for the first time. Spicy chicken curry over white rice. Oh my goodness, I loved it. This sparked my interest of the Bollywood Indian culture even more. When I decided I wanted to find out more about Bollywood and Indian culture, I decided to waste no time and find out, quote, how to plan the perfect Hindu wedding, unquote, via an Indian wedding planner's blog. Indian food truly reflects the culture of the prosperous sections of India. The bold spices and colorful garnishes used on the plate are just as lively as the fashion and the music. One of the most lively occasions that occurs in India is the marriage festival or wedding. This is considered to be one of the most important events in the lives of the entire family of the bride and the groom. Thus, marriage festivals are adorned with high fashion, gold, and elaborate ornaments. And, of course, food. In northern India, decadent foods like paneer, chicken, lamb, or shrimp curry, naans, and tandoori meat are often spread out on a large buffet table for guests. In southern India, however, the menu is generally meatless and focuses more on vegetables and rice. All food is served in equal portions on a large banana leaf. No matter which region of India you are from, a sweet confection called halva is a must. No doubt, the importance of the Indian wedding is reflected in the complex feast that follows it. When it comes to Bollywood, the fun and festive attitude of those involved truly is reflected in its cuisine. It's as the age-old saying goes, you are what you eat. Thank you.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. You have been listening to Food and Memory Stories on Standing Room Only on WFHB. Listening to stories from students in Rachel Barr's classroom at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship. These students were assigned to write and record stories about either their favorite memory surrounding food or a prominent food and a culture important to them. You can find all recipes online at wfhb.org. We now return to the show with Zoe Zalesny reading Not a Swede Dessert.
Not a Swede Dessert by Zoe Zalesny. It's no surprise that the Western culture of America is often identified with unhealthy lifestyles. In America, the culture is constantly modernizing. People use cars for transportation rather than walking, food comes out of a bag rather than off the table, and TV consumes a large portion of their time, rather than the outdoor entertainment. A few years back, I watched a documentary called Super Size Me. If you have never seen this gem of a documentary, it's about an average-sized man who vows to only eat from the McDonald's menu for a month as a social experiment. Toward the end, this man begins to show signs of extreme lethargy, high blood pressure, dependence on the fast food, depression, and plenty of other mental and physical health issues. It seems as though Americans choose to eat poorly even when there are other options. I am among this group of Americans that does not typically consider the other options. You would think after watching this documentary, I would want to treat my body like the temple it is, but no. Though I was sick to my stomach the entire time I watched that documentary, I still chose the option that was not healthy, but still fast and easy. The lonely afternoon after watching that documentary, I went to McDonald's and ordered a number one extra sauce and no onion. It seems as though Americans truly go for what is fast and what is easy, regardless of how awful it is for their body. In Sweden, things are entirely different. According to the blogger Haley Kramer from Inner Wellness, she wrote that fast food is not part of Swedes' typical daily routine. When there are no other options, they will eat McDonald's, but instead of greasy and salty fries, they get fruits and vegetables. Restaurants are expensive in Sweden, but they use the freshest ingredients and use local protein. Throughout the week, they eat healthier so they can have unhealthy foods during the weekends. Kramer states that Swedes make their food with real butter, not artificial, and their dairy products contain 2-4% fat because they believe more fatty ingredients in their smaller meals keep them fuller longer.
Swedes make filling desserts that are supposed to be enjoyed, which means they are filled with real butter, 2-4% fat milk, and they are typically not very healthy. But just because they like to have a good time with their desserts doesn't necessarily mean everything at a party or a celebratory event is unhealthy. On special occasions, they eat smorgasbord or sandwich cake, which is shaped as traditional cake with smoked fish, tender seafood, fresh vegetables, and soft, fresh baked bread bound together with a rich blend of cream cheese. The ingredients combine so well together you don't have to enjoy each individual component to absolutely love smorgasbord. While smorgasbord is a cake and dessert, it's not what Americans think as a sweet dish after dinner or to enjoy at a celebratory event. The diet of the Swedes reflect greatly on their healthy lifestyles and where they are geographically.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Hannah Steele read Red Velvet, It's a Piece of Cake.
My name is Hannah, and the title of my story is Red Velvet, It's a Piece of Cake. Every time my mom's side of the family got together, we always met at my grandma's house. She always made the best food. Her fried chicken and tenderloin were best, and that's what she normally would make. That's just the meal. Her desserts were even better. During Christmas, there's always a table stocked full of her Mexican wedding cookies, chocolate fudge, peanut butter fudge, and almost any type of cookie you could think of, and her two famous desserts, the snickerdoodle cookie and her red velvet cake. Anytime there was red velvet cake, it either meant it was somebody's birthday or Christmas, so we didn't get it very often. Red velvet cake has been around since the early 1930s, and it's closely tied to the state of Texas because of Adams Extract Company, which manufactured food coloring. They wanted to promote their food coloring, and red velvet cake was one recipe that needed food coloring. By the 50s and 60s, red velvet cake really took off and gained its popularity. I hope to carry on this dessert for special occasions like birthdays and Christmas. It's something that my grandma and grandpa have always made, and it turned into a tradition. Actually, now that I think about it, it's not even cake. The other day, my aunt bought red velvet cookies because it reminded us of my grandma. My family and grandma has made something as simple as cake into a special memory that we all hold close to our hearts.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. We'll now hear Rose Nicholson and Trinity Fleck read Russian to Get Your Bread.
Russian to Get Your Bread by Trinity Fleck and Rose Nicholson.
Picking our region took no time at all. We made the decision before the project even began. We chose Russia because it was closest to home while still leaving America in all its wonders. We chose Russia because my mother was born there, and she had some stories about the food that we still left and found our own topic today, which is pelmeni. Pelmeni is a Russian dumpling to say, but really it has its differences. Many dumplings, like in Chinese food, look like a half moon with crimped sides to hold all the filling inside, while Russians made their dumplings about the size of a walnut and closed the dumplings by pressing on the dough, then taking the two corners and making it into an ear-like shape. The reason to this is it makes it much more easier to store, and hunters found it very convenient because it freezes great and is very nourishing. Also, the water you cook it in can be used as a broth. You can have this ear bread on a plate with lashings of sour cream and chives on top, or nice steamy broth with the dumplings floating around.
People believe that Russia very likely got the idea of making these foods from the Mongols, which spread to Siberia and the Urals, to then which spread all the way to Eastern Europe. And people back this evidence up with the ingredients like something as simple but as important as black pepper. Black pepper came from northwestern China. It was not available in Russia and had to be imported. Yet, people still really don't know where pelmeni became a part of the Russian cuisine. It happened like abracadabra, and it was there, spreading like a wildfire, everyone adopting it and making family recipes for this one dish. You can find ear bread anywhere in Russia, from high-end restaurants to small cafes to even smaller homes, but never as a street food. You can find them packaged and frozen in most grocery stores in Russia because pelmeni is a bit time-consuming to make, but homemade will always be better. You can even buy pelmeni cutouts to speed up the process for cutting the dough, which would come in handy for someone who makes it more than twice a month or needs a very quick meal.
Every family does have its twists and turns on the recipe for this dish, and every family thinks theirs is better than someone else's. But who doesn't want to have the best pelmeni in the country? This dish is so simple, but can be so complex. And that's what leading to our last point, which is our experience. This dish was amazing. It tasted as if ravioli and Chinese dumplings met. First thing, we started on the dough. The recipe was rather simple, and we were done with the dough before we knew it. Then, we started on the filling. For ours, we used only beef and added sautéed onions and garlic. Once our dough had set, we began cutting out the circles, as well as filling them and folding them. Our water was boiling by the time, so we began to drop them in. After that, we decided to try and fry some. This was an amazing decision. Frying them made them 10 times better. You combine the meaty, wonderful center with a crisp outside, and it makes the dish wonderful. I hope you have learned something about this wonderful dish. Thank you for listening.
You can find that recipe online at wfhb.org. You just finished listening to students from Rachel Barr's classroom at the Academy of Science and Entrepreneurship read stories about foods that are important to them. These students were assigned to write and record stories about either their favorite memories surrounding food or a prominent food in a culture important to them. You can find all recipes online at wfhb.org.